When most Americans hear the word banjo, they think of an Appalachian instrument popular in bluegrass and Americana music. But Duke history professor Lorraine Dubois says the instrument is so much more than its stereotype. His love of the banjo led him to trace its history, first in Africa, then to the Caribbean. He wrote a comprehensive biography of the stringed instrument called The Banjo, America's African Instrument, and he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome back, Lorraine Dubois.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is banjo player Joe Newberry. Good to see you back as well, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about this book, Lorraine. You said that you didn't feel like a true American until you picked up a banjo. Tell me why.
Yeah, this book is in a sense a kind of ode, a historical ode to this amazing instrument and the object itself, and it tries to tell the story of how and why this object emerged. And I basically argue that through the instrument we can kind of get a whole sense of the broader currents of American history.
Well, and it is an odd instrument when you look at it and when you think about it. So, it's, you know, I mean, here is this drum skin attached that's used to resonate the strings. So how did it begin? Who began playing it?
I mean, that's the thing, right? When you look at a banjo, you think, what is this thing? Why is it built this way?
Yeah.
And what I actually first had to ask is, what is a banjo? What actually makes it a banjo? And the answer I ultimately came to is there are a lot of things that change about the formation of a banjo. But one thing that never changes is you always have to have this skin over some kind of resonator. So the relationship of the drum skin and the strings, and I say at the very beginning, this is the sound of, you know, strings humming over a skin. Mm. That's what makes it. And that's not just a melodic sound. It's also a sound that you kind of feel, you know, it kind of hums in a certain way.
Well, tell us how it began. Where do we think this instrument began? Who was playing it?
Mm-hmm. So throughout Africa, there are instruments that are built this way, many different types of instruments, but that all have these kinds of resonators with a skin over them. And what I argue in the book is that it's really kind of in the plantation zones of the Americas and the Caribbean and in parts of North America that this instrument is born precisely. I actually describe it as the first African instrument and a kind of trans-African or pan-African instrument to bring together various African musical traditions.
What was its ancestor in Africa? What was that like?
So there are multiple ones. There are some that look a lot like it, like the akonting or halam or certain West African instruments. But I actually argue that this was a kind of bringing together of lots of different styles of instruments into one new form, that it really exists in the Americas. It's not one particular African instrument.
And your research did send you back to 10th century Spain as well, right?
Absolutely. When I started going down the rabbit hole, you know, I realized how far this went and that the story of European and African musical interaction is a very, very, very deep one. And this is just one part of that longer story.
It also took you to instrument museums in Europe. I mean, it's interesting that they would become repositories of this instrument and its history. Tell us about that, that relationship.
Well, so I discovered that there's a whole scholarly field from the 19th century called organology of people who study the history of musical instruments, and they were studied often by gathering these huge collections of instruments, mostly in Europe. These are places in Brussels and Germany and elsewhere, and those have these vast, vast collections of instruments, many of them from the African continent, that allow us to reconstruct that history.
What did you find there? I mean, again, it was an interest in all things colonial, I suppose, at the time that generated these museums. How was the banjo represented in these museums?
I mean, the most important find and the one that really got me on the path to writing this book is that there is a banjo from Haiti that was collected in the 19th century and that turned up essentially in Paris in the 1990s, kind of taken out of a box, had been stored away for a long time. And this object is one of the very few gourd banjos we have from the 19th century that is still here today. And I write a lot about it in the book.
Is there a genealogy that takes us from Africa to the Caribbean to the mainland in the United States, or North America, or are these all developing separately after the Middle Passage?
It's difficult to say. I think what you do have is a kind of parallel development, similar situations giving rise to similar solutions. But this is also a very connected world, connected through water and the relationship between ports and rivers. And it's really through the water that this kind of thing circulates. And people circulated a lot. So I think at a certain point, people did see the instruments from other places and began making their own.
Talk about the role of the banjo and perhaps the musician in general among enslaved communities here in North America.
This was vital, right? I think that's kind of at the core of this story, is that music was a way to kind of survive, to resist, to sort of stay alive in this context. And so musicians in enslaved communities were really, really vital, and they provided a way to think about what was going on, to connect different communities. And really a big part of this book is trying to find as many of those as I could and document their stories. stories as well as possible and tell their history.
Well, the one of them, I mean, you got a book written by a man named William Smith called The Farmer's Register that described some of the activities, particularly celebrations known as Junkanoos, and I'm imagining they had all kinds of names. But give us that description. Tell us more about that and what we might have seen on the plantation.
Mm-hmm. So the banjo was always connected to forms like dance and to drumming and to other forms of music. And it was part of, in a sense, taking over space, taking kind of sonic control over space at certain times of year, especially around Christmas and festivals. So there's just an enormous amount of really interesting documentation, partly because this is when whites really saw this. It happened a lot outside their view, but this is when they saw it. People, in a sense, taking over the spaces of the plantation in some ways, telling their singing their traditions, singing songs sometimes about the masters. And music here was a kind of intellectual process as well of thinking about the condition.
What was the role of the banjo and how developed was it at this point?
So at this point, especially in 19th century America, we see the banjo really very, very present throughout the country. You find it in slave narratives mentioned all the time. So the story I tell in the book is of a kind of early emergence and then a consolidation of this instrument that became central to enslaved communities throughout the region of North America and the Caribbean.
In studying the banjo, too, you can look at some of these celebrations and what they might have looked like if the owner had given permission for some kind of celebration. And you describe some of the way that this looked, and we try to imagine what it might have sounded like.
Mm-hmm. There's always interaction, obviously, between these kind of African and African-American musics and then owners as well as poorer whites. And that's part of the story here, is that this is music that kind of went across these boundaries throughout.
Well, and it did. And in William Smith's description, he clearly is in love with the sound of the banjo. Mm-hmm. He is smitten by this sound.
What's fascinating, is writers, many white writers had a kind of ambiguous relationship. Obviously, they kind of often saw it as a kind of primitive instrument, as an African instrument. And yet you do see often seeping through a kind of deep admiration and love for this sound that comes through as well.
Joe Newberry, you clearly love the sound of this instrument. You've been playing it well for a long, long time. And I think, but part of what Loren is talking about, too, is the sense of community that certainly in enslaved communities, it played a vital role. But the banjo, I guess, to your mind, is still playing that role everywhere.
It plays that role everywhere. You know, I travel a lot, and I'm getting ready to go overseas tomorrow and teach at a music camp in the south of England. And, you know, whether I'm there or whether I'm in Ireland or Australia, I find that country people tend to like country music. And in North Carolina, we're particularly blessed because the line, the music line between black and white, would, you know, people would learn from each other. I used to love to hear Joe Thompson, the great African American fiddler from Mebane, and his cousin Odell, talk about listening to white musicians. I used to love to hear Joe say, "Oh, I'd just listen at him." We'd be sitting out curing tobacco, and I'd just listen at him. And that's where Joe learned his version of "Careless Love." One of the coolest things I've ever heard was at Clifftop up in West Virginia. Joe Thompson, who was in his 80s, and Marvin Gaster, both North Carolina Heritage Award winners. Marvin's a banjo player from Sanford. And they were, Joe said, "Do you know that Georgia Buck?" And Marvin said, "I believe I do." And to hear them both play that tune from each side of their fence, It was very stirring.
Can you play a song for us now, and maybe one that illustrates the African influence musically as well as the artifact itself, the banjo?
I'm going to now prove that it is possible to tune a banjo. Hold on. Here's a little bit of Roustabout. And the thing about Africans that I love, African playing, is that they're, the fifth string, the chanterelle, is also a drone string. When you listen to Africans play, there's also a low drone. Thank you.
Joe Newberry playing the banjo. He's here along with Lorraine Dubois. Lorraine has written a book called The Banjo, America's African Instrument. He's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop coming up tonight, 7 o'clock, and right now here with me on The State of Things. So what? Tell me more about that song itself.
It's a song. It's got a lot of floating verses, and it's played all over the East Coast in black and white communities. Mike Seeger did a lot of collecting on the Eastern Shore with African-American banjo players. My version, it comes a little bit from Mike and also from a great banjo player from the Blue Ridge named Fred Cockrum. And Fred traveled with medicine shows when he was a young man. And so he heard a lot of black players. And so I just love that backbeat. I just...
Well, Roustabouts, it was a name for the kind of workers who worked along the Mississippi, kind of loading ships. Yeah. And so and there's a whole passage in the book describing the kind of incredible music that developed in places like Cincinnati and elsewhere along the Mississippi. And Roustabouts were kind of at the center of that. So I think it's kind of an homage to that world as well.
Well, tell us more about the spread of the music itself. You write about the popularity of the banjo increasing with minstrelsy of the mm-hmm. 19th century.
Yeah, part of the story, of course, is that in the early 19th century, there was this kind of movement that emerges where you have white musicians performing in blackface, playing the banjo and playing music they're presenting as African-American music and that they've often learned from African-American musicians. This is the most popular form of pop culture in America throughout the 19th century, a huge influence on our culture. And I sort of describe this kind of epical moment in a sense where traditions of blackface met the banjo and created this new form.
But what does that say about identity? I mean, the idea that at that moment, white folks didn't feel like they could play it unless they were in blackface mm-hmm. and sort of their relationship to the music and the instrument. Clearly, we like it. We don't know how we can represent it.
Right. I mean, fundamentally, right, the way in which race has shaped how we think about music and maybe distorted how we think about music is part of the theme of this book. And I think it was very clear, right, that on the one hand, they were kind of denying access to the stage to African-Americans who eventually were, in fact, many of them actually performed in blackface or as minstrels themselves later in the 19th century. But at the same time, of course, they kind of understood that this was this powerful American form that they wanted to channel. And so there's a deep ambiguity there. And there's continued to be an ambiguity that I kind of try to contest in the book where people have in some ways kind of suppressed or denied this African and African-American history of the banjo.
It didn't get entirely lost outside of minstrelsy. The banjo also makes its way into jazz, as you point mm-hmm. out. So it makes its way into what was then, in the early part of the 20th century, a mainstream form mm-hmm. of American music.
Yeah, there's a photo in the book of James Reese Europe, who had this massive orchestra with dozens and dozens of banjos in the early 20th century performed at Carnegie Hall. And all these jazz players who played on the riverboats used banjos early. So there's all these places. I mean, the thing about this instrument is it's found its way into so many sort of core American musics in so many surprising ways.
When did it, or has it stopped evolving, but when did it become the instrument that I would recognize mm-hmm. today?
That's really a phenomenon of the 19th century. So you move from the gourds to having kind of these rings, these kind of wooden rings. And then there's been endless kind of sort of improvements to kind of make the head stay on better and other sorts of things. But it kind of gets into its modern form in the 19th century.
Lorraine Dubois is a professor of history at Duke University. His new book is The Banjo, America's African Instrument. And Joe Newberry is with us as well on The State of Things. Joe, we've got about a minute and a half in this segment. Could you play us out?
Down the road, down the road. I got a sugar baby down the road, down the road, down the road. I got a sugar baby down the road.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today talking about the banjo and its versatility with Lorraine Dubois, author of the new biography of the banjo, and musician Joe Newberry. Lorraine's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham tonight at 7 o'clock. So talk about the difficulty, Lorraine, of putting just finding out about the banjo. So much of this history, it seems to me, might be pretty difficult to locate.
Yeah, this was a long process, about a decade long, actually, of gathering bits and pieces everywhere I could find them in order to tell this bigger story, in various archives, looking through various narratives, and really gleaning little bits of details and trying to put them together into a bigger tale.
So talk about, where do you find this information? Again, the narratives, what was happening on plantations? I would think finding out anything about that could be pretty difficult, given the documentation.
Absolutely. So a lot of travelers occasionally we have these very precious accounts that usually came from outsiders or travelers who had noticed something that people who lived there didn't ever write about, but a visitor would write about it. You do have slave narratives later that describe from that side. A lot of visual clues, looking for paintings where the banjo showed up, a few paintings, and you can get a lot out of those paintings as well.
In the book, you point to a song that Joe Newberry plays called Swannanoa Tunnel, and found that very important. Talk about the importance of that song to you.
Well, this is actually, sort of from that song comes one of the chapter titles, which is Rings Like Silver, Shines Like Gold, which is, I think, a great description of what the banjo sounds like. It's a song that describes the kind of experience of convict labor and building the tunnels that built the railroads in North Carolina. So it's one of these songs that really tells a lot of history about our country in North Carolina, but also sort of celebrates the long-standing presence of the banjo in our lives.
Joe, can you play that one for us?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
When they ask you to come play the banjo on a show,
play the banjo.
I'm going back to the Swannanoa Tunnel, buddy, that's my home, baby, that's my home, Asheville Junction.
Joe Newberry, Swannanoa Tunnel, helping us talk about the history of the banjo today with author and historian Lorraine Dubois. Great song, Joe.
Thank you, Frank.
We should ask you to play the banjo on the show more often. I guess that's
true. I've never heard that. I've dreamed of this moment.
So let's talk about why people hate on the banjo, Lorraine. You and I both love this thing. I think it does. It shines like silver and sounds like gold, or I got the other way around. Sounds like silver, shines like
rings
gold.
Like rings,
rings
like silver,
shines like gold. Beautiful instrument. Yeah. Why do people hate it?
Taj Mahal, once when he played here, he said he pulled out his banjo, everybody cheered, and he said, it's the only place where I pull out my banjo and people cheer rather than running. But I do think it's partly the cultural heritage and all the kind of baggage and interesting things around it. I mean, part of the point of this book was to tell people the real sort of story of this instrument. I think the more you know its history, the more you'll love it.
What was the coolest thing you found out about the banjo?
So, I think the coolest thing was how deeply intertwined it was with spiritual practice, with connecting to Africa, with all this kind of long history of communities that were in exile and kind of dispersed into Appalachia as well, finding a kind of home in the instrument.
Lorraine Dubois, the author of The Banjo, America's African Instrument, speaks tonight, 7 o'clock, Regulator Bookshop. Thanks, Lorraine. Good
Thank
to
you.
Have you here. And Joe Newberry, a musician who is taking his southern banjo playing all over the world. He's going to be in England next, and we'll have details on Joe's records and his engagements at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Frank.